as you all know, this evening we have a debate between the Socialist Party of Great Britain, represented on my left by Mr. E. Hardy, and on my right, the International Communist Current, represented by Mr. Alan Ward. The subject of the debate is Which Way Socialism? The debate will take the following form. The ICC will open for a half an hour, and the Socialist Party will follow. Then we'll have approximately 45 minutes, depending upon the questions and discussion, from the floor, followed by 10 minutes winding up by both parties. I call upon Mr. Alan Ward of the ICC to open up. Which way is socialism?
Right, well, I have a lot to say, and I'll try and squeeze it all into half an hour if possible. In order to avoid having fruitless arguments about what we already agree on, I think it's worth just drawing attention to the points that the ICC more or less agrees with the SPGB about. And we can take as a starting point the five basic statement of principles, the first 5 points or so of the SPGB. We agree that capitalism is the system that dominates the world everywhere today. Every country in the world is capitalist, including all the so-called socialist countries. We agree that as long as capitalism exists, there will be a class struggle between the two antagonistic classes, the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. We agree that this class struggle can only have one resolution, which is socialism. And despite one or two criticisms of the definition that appears in the SPGB's publications, we agree broadly that socialism is indeed a world, stateless, moneyless society without frontiers and so on, without wage labour or commodity production. And we reject completely all the so-called socialist organisations of the left who actually have a programme of state capitalism, the Communist Party, the Trotskyists and so on. We agree that the emancipation of the working class will bring with it the emancipation of the whole of humanity. And we agree that the emancipation of the working class can only be carried out by the whole working class itself, and it can't be done by a minority on behalf of the working class. In a sense, these basic principles have been the foundations of Marxism from the very beginning. But Marxism is not a fixed creed of static principles. It's the theoretical elaboration of the real movement of the working class, a class which can learn only through its own experience and struggle. Those who are able to understand the lessons of this experience of the working class are the continuators of Marx's method, and are able to help clarify the content of the socialist program. Those who are unable to grasp these lessons either end up passing over to the other side of the barricades, the bourgeoisie, or they end up as sclerotic sects who are unable to add anything to the understanding of the working class while not entirely deserting the camp of the working class. It's our contention that the SPGB suffers from this disease of sclerosis, and that this disease could indeed lead it to going over to the bourgeoisie in the revolutionary upheavals that lie ahead.
Can someone close the outer door, please?
Is this microphone working?
Is the microphone working?
It's supposed to be working, I don't know.
You're not working, they're just for show. Oh, I'll try and speak louder. Marxism, if you like, began with the basic affirmation of the struggle between the two classes in capitalist society, and affirmed that this conflict could only be resolved in a classless society. But the actual road which would lead to this society was extremely hazy at the beginning of Marxism, the time when Marx and Engels wrote the Communist Manifesto. And the reason for that was that the working class itself had not really set foot on the road that led to socialism. For example, in the Communist Manifesto, we find that the economic measures advocated by Marx, by the Communist League, would, like the statification of capital, the centralization of capital in the hands of the state, would, if put in practice today, simply lead to a situation of state capitalism. And in this sense, they represented the immaturity of the workers' movement at that time. Similarly, the political program outlined in the Communist Manifesto, the idea that the working class would take hold of the old capitalist state and use it for its own purposes, also reflected the immaturity of the working class struggle at that epoch. And it was the subsequent experience of the working class that led Marx to reconsider this basic political affirmation in the Communist Manifesto. In 1848, the insurrections in Paris of the French workers allowed Marx to begin to understand the need for the working class not to struggle to take over the old state machine, but to struggle against it, as he wrote in the 18th of Brumaire. In its struggle against the revolution, the parliamentary republic found itself compelled to strengthen, along with the repressive measures, the resources and centralization of governmental power. All revolutions perfected this machine instead of smashing it. Reflecting on the same experience in a letter to Kugelmann in 1871, Marx repeated this. He said, "If you look at the last chapter of my 18th Brumaire, you will find that the next attempt at the French Revolution will be no longer as before to transfer the bureaucratic and military machine from one hand to another, but to smash it. And this is the preliminary condition for any real people's revolution on the continent. And this is what our heroic party comrades in Paris are attempting." The last statement is, of course, referring to the Paris Commune, which was then in full swing. And for Marx and Engels, the number one lesson of the Paris Commune was precisely, as they said in the introduction, the later introduction to the Communist Manifesto, one thing especially was proved by the Commune: the working class cannot simply lay hold of the ready-made state machinery and wield it for its own purposes. And so important was this lesson for Marx and Engels that in the later introduction to the Manifesto, they stressed it as the main alteration that would be necessary if the Communist Manifesto would be rewritten in the 1880s or 90s. The need to destroy the old state machine and institute a new one. A new form of political power, which, unlike the old one, could provide a framework for working out the emancipation of labour. And as Marx underlined in the Civil War in France, this was a state that abolished parliamentarism. The Commune, he wrote, was to be a working, not a parliamentary body, executive and legislative at the same time. It broke up the standing army and bureaucracy and made it possible for the proletariat to control its delegates. Now, the Paris Commune of 1871 was in many ways, although a crucial lesson of working class struggle, it was a lesson for the future. Socialism could not have been instituted in that period. Capitalism had not yet become a world system. And while it was still expanding across the world, the workers' movement had no choice but to organize to struggle for reforms through Parliament and through the trade unions. Reforms that were possible in that epoch and therefore necessary to struggle for. But the fact that the workers' movement gave so much energy to struggling for reforms inevitably had a corrosive and corrupting effect on its parties. Reformism and what was called revisionism grew up throughout the Second International in the parties of social democracy. And the ideas came that capitalism would gradually reform itself into socialism, that revolution was no longer necessary because capitalism could solve its economic problem, and that it was enough to elect a majority of workers' parties of workers' delegates into parliament to either gradually reform capitalism out of existence or institute socialism by decree. It's also worth pointing out that it was always the parliamentary delegates of the social democracy who tended to be the worst revisionists and the worst reformists. And this, of course, wasn't accidental. And these reformist ideas, these illusions in Parliament, which the revolutionaries at that time called parliamentary cretinism, affected even the most clear elements in the working class, even Marx and Engels themselves. Engels began to forget the lessons of the Paris Commune and to bring back the idea of the working class taking power by electing a party to Parliament and instituting socialism in this way. And even Marx hinted that this might be a possibility in some countries, although neither Marx and Engels thought, even considered the possibility that such a takeover of power could happen without violent confrontations with the old ruling class. However, it's important to understand how deeply these illusions affected the working class movement as a whole. If we turn to the origins of the Socialist Party of Great Britain, we can see that it was on one hand, when it emerged in the early 1900s, a healthy reaction against these reformist ideas, the reformist degeneration of the Second International from which it broke. But the fact that it attacked the reformism of the Second International did not mean that it could really break from all the errors of the Second International. And in particular, the erroneous views about taking power through Parliament were inherited by the SPGB. It too was affected by the general amnesia which had led the working class movement to forget the lessons of 1871. And because of the very strong tendencies towards sectarianism right from the beginning of the SPGB, the conviction that it alone understood the socialist programme, a sectarian disease which has continued ever since its existence began, it was unable to grasp the lessons of the class struggle in the period that was opening up at the time of its foundation. The great experience of 1905 in Russia, can't stop that from saying, in which the working class first threw up the Soviets and new forms of struggle of the mass strike, completely passed the SPGB by. It was completely unable to see that a new period of struggle was opening up for the working class, in which all the old methods of struggle were completely outplayed and reactionary. And this inability to grasp the lessons of the new period were even more marked during the Russian Revolution and the revolutionary wave which followed and spread throughout Europe in reaction to the First World War. The SPGB, although at the beginning, and this is worth pointing out, the SPGB felt a certain sympathy for the Russian Revolution and saw it as a heroic attempt of the workers of Russia, rather like the Commune, very quickly the SPGB turned its back on the experience of the Russian workers, refused to express its solidarity with them, and took up the completely erroneous arguments of the Mensheviks that socialism was not possible in Russia because it was a backward economy, ignoring completely what the revolutionaries of the time were saying, that the October Revolution, the seizure of power by the working class in Russia, was not instituted with the aim of building socialism in Russia alone, but was the first step in a world proletarian revolution, because only on a world scale could socialism be built. And before very long, the SPGB had completely abandoned the initial solidarity it may have felt with the Russian workers, and argued erroneously, because the new period made capitalist revolutions a historic impossibility, that the Russian Revolution was nothing but a capitalist revolution. And it's not surprising at the same time that they stopped celebrating the Commune as well, in 1918, I believe. The Commune was no longer seen by the SPGB as something to learn from for the working class. However, the real movement which millions and millions of workers were throwing themselves into in Europe, in Russia and elsewhere, showed that indeed a new period of capitalism had been born, the period of proletarian revolution. And everywhere the workers' struggle confronted the old forms and institutions, unions, parliament and social democracy, and were building new forms of struggle which corresponded to the interests of the revolutionary struggle, the workers' councils and communist parties. And it was in response to this movement that Lenin and other revolutionaries were able to reaffirm the old lessons which Marx and Engels had defended so strongly, of the need to completely destroy the old bourgeois state and replace it with new organs of power. And these organs of power, as the workers themselves were showing, were the workers' councils. The Russian Revolution ended in defeat, of course, but it wasn't the SPGB which was able to analyse why the Russian Revolution had been defeated. On the contrary, only those elements who had expressed their solidarity with it in initial phases, when it was still a proletarian revolution, were able to understand and contribute something to understand why it had failed. And these were the left communists who were gradually expelled or left the Third International when it degenerated. People like the German, Dutch and Italian left. It's true that after the Russian Revolution, along with the left communists, the SPGB continued to defend against all the phony visions of socialism put forward by the now capitalist communist parties. It continued to say what socialism was, and it continued to impose imperialist wars, despite a number of vacillations on Spain, for example. But it was unable really to give any understanding to the new period that opened up, and unable to really take up a revolutionary opposition to imperialist wars. And so although the SPGB managed to keep in some ways a flag of socialism flying in these years, it's the communist left from whom the ICC takes its traditions, because they were the ones who were able to clarify what the real lessons of the new period were. I'll now try, having given that basic outline of where we think we come from and where we think the SPGB came from, I'll try to go more deeply into the question, the basic question of which way to socialism, and why we think the SPGB's way to socialism is either at best a fantasy and at worst a way of reorganizing capitalism. If I may briefly sum up what appears to be the SPGB's vision of how socialism is going to come about, it says that we'll get socialism when the majority of the working class is sufficiently educated, mainly perhaps thanks to the untiring educational efforts of the SPGB, and perhaps with a little help from the crisis of capitalism. The working class, having realized the need to have socialism, will then either join or vote for the SPGB to go to Parliament, where its mandated socialist delegates will simply abolish wage labour and commodity production, overnight perhaps, although the SPGB never tire of telling us that people have got to be awake when socialism happens. This is fair enough, but we'll go into this, why this description is somewhat inadequate. First of all, the SPGB have no understanding at all of the relationship between the present struggles of the working class and the development of socialist understanding. Their view of the way consciousness develops in the working class is essentially a pedagogic one. They see it in terms of the SPGB, perhaps, converting each worker as a worker into becoming a socialist. And when we've got enough socialists, we'll be able to have socialism. They don't see, as Marx pointed out many, many times when he tried to show why the working class was the revolutionary class, that it's the struggle of the working class itself that leads it to develop a socialist understanding, that it's mass revolutionary consciousness develops out of mass struggles of the class. Struggles which may begin as economic struggles, but which in certain conditions are forced to become political struggles, are forced to become struggles in which the working class becomes aware of the need to overthrow capitalism and build a new society. The SPGB does not see any connection between the struggles that are going on today and the future struggle for socialism. Therefore, they can make the horrible mistake of considering that the trade unions are still working class organizations. And in a recent article on Gronix, they advised Len Murray to go back to his job, which he's paid for, i.e. representing the working class, and keep out of politics, which shows a complete failure to understand that the job of Len Murray is precisely to control the working class and to politically dominate the working class on behalf of the capitalist state. They also think, of course, that Parliament and elections can be vehicles for developing the consciousness of the working class, that the working class can indeed express a socialist consciousness through participating in Parliament and elections. In reality, elections and Parliament, far from expressing the consciousness of the working class, atomize the working class, fragment it into a mass of amorphous citizens, dilute it amongst the rest of the population, which has no objective interest in socialism. They reinforce illusions in the working class that we're living in a society which is really democratic. And it's the fact that these illusions that are spread by participating in Parliament no longer can do anything but prevent the working class from developing a socialist consciousness, that communists today oppose all participation in Parliament and in elections. In order to develop its consciousness, the working class has to struggle, and its struggle has to take an organized form. And this organization of the class, the self-organization, can only be on a basis which regroups the whole class, where the class expresses itself as a class. In other words, at the point of production, where the workers are defined collectively as workers. These organs assemblies, factory committees, strike committees, and in revolutionary confrontations, workers' councils, allow the whole class to participate in the struggle and not passively sit back, which is the only way that one can participate in parliamentary elections. Of course, the consciousness of the working class is also expressed through the formation of political parties. But a party, by definition, can only be a part of the working class. The job of a working class party is not to take power or represent the class. And contrary to both what the old Social Democrats, the Bolsheviks, and the SPGB thought, the SPGB says, quoting from the Socialist Standard of October 1974, that the only form of organisation which can take political power is a political party. The SPGB may say that this means that one day everyone, all the workers will be in the Socialist Party of Great Britain, or at least a great majority of them. But in any case, this is in fact a version of the old mistake of substitutionism, the idea that a party can take power on behalf of the working class. And we completely reject this idea. We say that only the working class as a whole can take political power. The fact that the SPGB separates the real struggles of the working class, the struggles against exploitation, from the revolutionary struggle, means that it has a completely fantastic idea of what the revolution will be like. It thinks the revolution will be a respectable and orderly affair. And when one reads the SPGB's version of how socialism is going to come about, one is reminded of Engels' words. Have these gentlemen ever seen a revolution? It is the act whereby one part of the population imposes its will upon the other part by means of rifles, bayonets, and cannon. In the explanation of their basic principles, the SPGB says that socialism can't come out of a civil war. And they're able to say this by saying that a civil war can only be a minority imposing its will on the mass of the class, and that a minority cannot dragoon the class into socialism. This is, of course, true. The workers can't be dragooned into socialism. It's true that the working class has long gone beyond the old blankist methods of a small minority seizing power on behalf of the working class. In order to have socialism, you must have a majority of the class conscious of the need for socialism. But even with all these factors, civil war between the proletariat and the bourgeoisie is inevitable. Capitalism is the most brutal and most violent class society in history, and it won't give up without a fight. History shows that you can only win over those elements who work for the capitalist state by the most resolute class struggle. The example of the women of Paris, the workers of Paris, who disarmed the guards who were sent to take their guns away from them, is a classic example of this. Only by struggling on their own terrain can the workers win over those forces of the state who are there to repress them. It's not a question of revolutionaries glorifying violence. In fact, the more conscious and the more organised the working class is, the less violence it will need. The point is, however, that it is criminal to spread illusions in the possibility of a peaceful revolution. In order to avoid getting massacred by the bourgeoisie, the workers themselves must be armed, and Marx insisted on this many, many times, for example, when he was writing about the class struggles in 1848 and again in 1871. The SPGB may reply that they are indeed prepared to use what they call the armed forces to suppress a violent anti-socialist minority once they've got power. But as I've tried to point out before, the lesson of the Paris Commune is precisely that the old machinery of the state cannot be taken over and used. The bourgeois state is not an empty vessel that can be used for any purpose whatsoever. Its form is dictated by its function. It is inherently an oppressive organ, an organ for exploitation and oppression. And this is why, whenever the workers go into struggle, they are forced to struggle outside of and against the state and not inside it. This is true from 1871, in 1905 when they set up the Soviets, and today in any strike when the workers have to struggle outside the trade unions. Because the working class revolution is the first revolution in history which doesn't aim to set up a new form of exploitation, it's impossible, like the bourgeoisie could, to take over the old state. It has to be destroyed. It may be true that Engels had the idea that at least some parts of the old state machine could be taken over, and that you could lop off what he called the worst bits, i.e. that Parliament, because it was a democratic form, could be taken over by the workers, and then they'd lop off the bureaucratic and military parts of the state. This was a wrong understanding then, and it's an absurdity today. In this epoch of capitalism, the epoch of capitalist decay, everywhere Parliament has ceased to have any real power. Real power is passed outside Parliament, and every state is essentially a regime of totalitarian state capitalism, whether we're talking about the Eastern Bloc countries or the Western Bloc. Parliament is there simply as a facade to cover over the really repressive face of the state. It's, if you look at Britain, where the real power of decisions are taken, it's outside Parliament, in the army, in the executive, in the cabinet, anything but Parliament. And the easy way in which the bourgeoisie, even in Britain, dispensed with Parliament in 1926 or 1939 should convince anyone of this. However, even if Parliament was not the complete shell, the complete facade that it is, even if it had real power, the workers could not use it. As I've said before, the form of Parliament is hostile to the working class developing its consciousness, because it breaks the working class up. Elections break the working class up into a mass of atomized citizens. It's impossible for the working class to exercise political power through Parliament. Leaving aside the fact that the bourgeoisie, of course, will be represented in any Parliament, the workers can only take political power through organs which regroup it as a class. This is why the Paris Commune was a higher form of power than Parliament. And this is why the workers' councils are a higher form still than the Commune, precisely because they are based on the class organizing itself as a class. Only those organs which allow the whole class to participate in the taking of decisions, to control the delegates that they elect. Parliamentary delegates can't be recalled, they can't be controlled from outside, they can't even be mandated. The only other way of controlling these parliaments, these parliamentary delegates, would be through the party. And once again, we have the old mistake that the party's role is to substitute for the class in the construction of socialism. And just as the working class needs its own class organs to take political power, it must have its own class organs to reorganize production and create socialism. The taking of political power by the working class is only the first step towards socialism. The real transformation of social relations involves mass activity by the working class on an international scale. It needs the direct taking over of the means of production by the producers. It means breaking down the separation between the producers and the means of production. It means the setting up of organs which fuse political, social, and economic tasks. And again, forms such as the workers' councils are alone able to do this. Parliament is completely unable to do this. It's a national form, even in those few countries of the world where it even exists. It's totally separated from the producers. It has no relationship to the working class as a class. The SPGB never tried to show how having parliamentary delegates, simply electing a number of parliamentary delegates, will abolish wage labour. The abolition of wage labour is an enormous social transformation on a worldwide scale, and it's a fantasy to think that by having a few people in Parliament and passing any decree you like, wage labour will disappear. Wage labour will only disappear by the conscious self-activity of the working class, and this means working class organisation. The SPGB never, of course, considers the international problems of the revolution, the fact that the working class is still a minority of the world's population on a world scale. The fact that socialism cannot exist even for a single moment in one country is never considered by the SPGB. None of these questions are answered by the SPGB in their attempts to describe how socialism will come about. And the reason for this is that their vision of socialism is a fantasy which will never happen. I might say that even if it did happen, that for some impossible reason, the working class decided one day to elect the SPGB into Parliament, the SPGB, despite all its good intentions, which we don't doubt, would end up being fused into the bureaucratic machine of the state. With all the best intentions of the world, it would be the state and the national economy which would impose its will on the SPGB and would lead the SPGB to instituting a regime of state capitalism. But however, this is, as I said, a fantasy. It's not going to happen like this. What is going to happen? In the last 10 years or so, we've been living in a period of re-emerging class struggle. The capitalist crisis has reappeared in all its brutality, and the working class all over the world has responded to this, indicating that once again humanity is faced directly with the choice between socialism or barbarism, the communist revolution or another world war. It's by struggling against the attacks that capitalism is forced to mount on it, the working class will gradually see the need to wage a political struggle against the system, to institute a new social order. And revolutionaries have a crucial role to play in this. And in the mass struggles that open up on a world scale, and are already opening up, as in Spain, for example, the bourgeoisie will respond by trying to put forward democracy as a way of preventing the working class from struggling for its own interests, as it did in 1919 in Germany, for example, as it's doing in Spain and elsewhere today. It will try to get the workers to abandon their own struggle and to subordinate their own organs of struggle to democracy and to parliament. And it's in these moments that face us, that will be facing us in the not too distant future, that the SPGB will be faced with a crucial choice which will determine whether or not it's going to remain a working class organisation. In these struggles in which millions of workers will be confronting the whole apparatus of democracy, in which the whole of the bourgeoisie will be screaming at the working class, stop these horrible minority violent struggles, be sensible and subordinate yourself to the democratic will of Parliament, what will the SPGB say then? Will it be able to throw off its old dogmas that it's held for so many years and participate in the mass struggle of the class? Or will it join in this hypocritical chorus of the bourgeoisie? Will it tell the workers to stop this useless struggle, to have a sensible, British, orderly struggle for socialism through Parliament? Unfortunately, in times like this, there's no room for vacillation. At times, when the class lines are drawn so clearly, like they were in October 1917, which we at least will be celebrating as a victory of the working class, there is no middle way between either the violent dictatorship of the bourgeoisie or the revolutionary dictatorship of the proletariat.